slave and cut off his ear. In other words, under Babylonian law, which is widely regarded as morally advanced for its time, cutting off the ear was a punishment for the slave who wanted to be free. In contrast, the Torah rules that the slave's ear is only pierced for wanting to remain a slave. As Walter Kaufman, the Princeton philosopher, noted, this law is a deliberate echo of Hammurabi's ruling, an echo that seems designed to bring out the deep differences between the two legislations. Were daughters really sold into slavery? Verse 7. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not be freed as male slaves are. As I will explain, parents could not sell their children into slavery. What is depicted here is not about slavery, and certainly not about sexual slavery. It is about indentured servitude. People understandably think of it as slavery because the Hebrew word eved is almost always translated as slave. But this word also means servant. Moses, for example, is called an eved of God. No one assumes he was a slave of God. Furthermore, a girl could become a maidservant, not a slave, only if her family sold her. No one else could sell a girl into slavery. Of course, any notion of parents selling their children is disturbing. But thousands of years ago, it was done everywhere, including, albeit rarely, in Israel in circumstances of abject poverty. As reported later in the Bible, Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 5, although we are of the same flesh and blood as our fellow Jews, and though our children are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. In the 12th century, Maimonides, in his Code of Jewish Law, ruled, a man may not sell his daughter as a maidservant unless he became impoverished to the extent that he owns nothing, neither land nor other property, not even the clothing he is wearing. As Maimonides' ruling makes clear, the Torah is therefore putting parameters around a tragic practice. But recognizing that it almost inevitably occurs under dire circumstances, as is clear from the next verse, the Torah assures the girl many protections. For example, the girl was sold to a man with the expectation either he or his son would marry her. Of course, to most people today, it is unacceptable that a woman's family, essentially meaning her father, would choose a daughter's spouse. But that has been the case in all societies throughout history and in many societies to this day. Women and men began to freely choose whom they would marry only in the relatively recent past, and almost exclusively in parts of the Western world. Furthermore, having one's family choose a woman's husband in no way meant sexual slavery. If it did, virtually every married woman in history was a sexual slave. Verse 8. If she proves to be displeasing to her master, who designated her for himself, he must let her be redeemed. He shall not have the right to sell her to outsiders, since he broke faith with her. The Hebrew, translated here as outsiders, literally means a foreign nation. That would imply the Torah may have originally allowed the maidservant to be sold to another Israelite, as opposed to a non-Israelite, in which case she would likely be used, abused, and resold. However, from very early times, it was understood as a prohibition to sell her to anyone, including another Israelite. If neither the master nor his son marries the young woman, the master is regarded as having acted deceitfully, a sin greatly magnified if he then sells her off to someone else, which is expressly forbidden here. Thus, if the master decides he does not wish her as a wife for himself or his son, since he is not allowed to sell her, he must let her be redeemed by her relatives. Verse 9. And if he designated her for his son, he shall deal with her as is the practice with free maidens. The maidservant is guaranteed protection as a wife of either the father or the son. The very fact she is to be treated as if she were a free maiden is yet another reason to believe the Torah is not referring to slavery when speaking about a family selling its daughter. Verse 10. If he marries another, he must not withhold from this one her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. If the master marries another woman in addition to his maidservant, The maidservant wife is not to be neglected in favor of the new wife. She retains the rights and privileges of a wife. What is remarkable here is the concept of conjugal rights. Sarna points out that of all the ancient Near Eastern law codes, the Torah was unique in asserting a woman is legally entitled to sexual gratification. And what slave has ever had conjugal or any other rights? A sold daughter is not only not to be a sex slave, she is not to be a chattel slave either. She is not owned property. Therefore, it is not accurate to call a daughter who is sold by her parents a slave. She is sold to a man who will eventually marry her. And if he doesn't want to marry her, his son can. If neither does, she goes free. See next verse. That is not slavery. Verse 11. If he fails her in these three ways, she shall go free without payment. The Torah restates that many obligations are owed to this daughter who was sold. The Torah delineates protection after protection of the girl involved. She has human rights. She has the dignity of marriage. She cannot be sold. She is to be redeemed by her family if she is not to be a wife. And she even has conjugal rights. Verse 12. He who fatally strikes a man shall be put to death. The prohibition against murder is the most important ethical commandment, and thus it is dealt with next in what is essentially a recapitulation and explication of the Ten Commandments. As Maimonides ruled, there is no offense about which the Torah is so strict as it is about bloodshed. As it is said, you shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land. Numbers chapter 35, verse 33. Capital punishment for premeditated murder is the only law that appears in all five books of the Torah. Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, this verse and verse 14 in this chapter, Leviticus chapter 24, verse 17, Numbers chapter 35, verses 16 and following, and Deuteronomy chapter 19, verses 11 through 13. But the Torah makes it clear in the very next verse and elsewhere that when a homicide is unintentional or unpremeditated, capital punishment is not imposed. Unintentional homicide. Verse 13. If he did not do it by design, but it came about by an act of God, I will assign you a place to which he can flee. This verse refers to a killing that is not premeditated, what we would generally deem an accidental killing. The term act of God is used to this day, in insurance policies, for example, to denote such accidents. Three examples of such accidents are offered in Numbers chapter 35, verses 22 through 23. Pushing someone without malice aforethought, throwing an object that hits someone unintentionally, and inadvertently dropping a heavy object upon another person. In the ancient world, if a member of one family killed a member of another, the family of the victim would feel compelled or at the very least permitted to defend its honor by either killing the killer or even other members of the killer's family. These blood feuds were entrenched in ancient society, so it would have been impossible to banish them altogether. The Torah instead provides a means of protecting the accidental killer from avengers. The words, I will assign you a place to which he can flee, refer to a city of refuge, a designated place in which a person who killed through accident or non-criminal negligence was guaranteed legal protection. See Numbers chapter 35, verses 9 through 15. Unlike in other cultures, there is no sanctuary for murderers. Verse 14. When a man schemes against another and kills him treacherously, you shall take him from my very altar to be put to death. In societies as diverse as Phoenicia, Syria, Greece, and Rome, the altar of a temple provided protection to fugitives, including those guilty of premeditated murder. The Torah was the only legal code in the ancient world to declare there is no sanctuary for murderers. Since man was created in God's image, the last place a murderer could or should find refuge is in a house of the Creator. A later biblical text confirms this Torah law was not just on the books, but was enforced. When the late King David's general, Joab, a man with much blood on his hands, tried to claim sanctuary by holding on to an altar, King Solomon ordered his leading general to kill Joab on the spot as punishment for the blood of the innocent that Joab has shed. 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 28 through 34. The Torah wording, "You shall take him from my very altar to be put to death," also makes it clear people are not to rely on God to execute murderers. It is human beings who are responsible for executing one who deliberately takes the life of another. "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed." Genesis chapter 9, verse 6. The Torah's view is in direct opposition to the frequently stated argument that only God has the right to take the life of a murderer. People may make this argument, but there is no basis in the Bible for it. Hitting a parent is a grave offense. Verse 15. "He who strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death." A father or mother who is struck does not have to die in order for the child to deserve to be put to death. This law is a radical defense of the uniquely high status the Torah gives to parents. This is shown by the fact that only when one hits a parent, not hitting an official, not even a king, is one punishable by death. Hitting a parent is a profound violation of the commandment to honor one's parents. A child of almost any age who hits a parent has not only dishonored, but also humiliated his parent and completely undermined the parent's authority. While the Torah does not specify what exactly constitutes striking a parent, the Talmud ruled that to be subject to the death penalty, a person would have to hit his parent hard enough to draw blood. While the Torah forbids striking a parent, Talmudic law subsequently forbade a parent to hit a grown child. The Talmud even records the view that a parent who strikes an adult child should be excommunicated, lest that provoke the child to hit back and thereby violate the serious biblical prohibition. This law also protects the child. Even if hit severely, the parent is not allowed to kill the child. Only a court can. "Will be put to death" means a court will do it. The Hebrew phrase mot yumat, "he shall be put to death," always refers to a court condemning a guilty party to death. Instead of allowing the parent to kill a violent child, which was permitted, for example, in Roman law, the parent must instead bring the child to court. Since we have no record of an Israelite being executed for hitting a parent, we should infer Jews understood the punishment was meant to show how serious the offense was, see commentary to verse 17, rather than an injunction to actually be carried out. Finally, and of particular significance, the Torah makes it clear hitting either a father or mother is an equally terrible act. Over and over, as in the fifth commandment, the Torah emphasizes the equal status of both parents. The father is not more important than the mother. If the Torah didn't hold both parents in equally high esteem, it would have made striking one's father a greater offense than striking one's mother. Verse 16. "He who kidnaps a man, whether he has sold him or is still holding him, shall be put to death." In Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 7, Moses speaks of punishing with death a slave-trading kidnapper who abducts a fellow Israelite. Here, the Torah is clearly referring to the kidnapping of any person. The Hebrew word is ish, the generic term for person. The kidnapping of any human being, regardless of religion, race, or nationality, is a capital offense. The English translation here uses the word kidnaps, but the Torah uses the word gonev, which means steal. It is the same word used in the Eighth Commandment. One reason that commandment was always understood, first and foremost, as prohibiting kidnapping, that is, stealing a person. It therefore bears repeating. The Eighth Commandment, as well as the explicit prohibition against stealing a human being in this verse, would have forbidden most forms of slavery, given that historically most slavery began with the stealing of human beings. Cursing a parent is also a grave offense. Verse 17. "He who insults his father or his mother shall be put to death." The Hebrew word mikalel, translated here as insults, is more accurately translated as curses. The Torah is likely referring to cursing in which the name of God is invoked, thereby simultaneously showing contempt both for God and one's parents. See a related case in Leviticus chapter 24, verses 10 through 16, and verse 23, which does not involve a parent, but which involves the only instance in the Torah of cursing which results in a death sentence. As we do not know of a case in which a child who cursed a parent was actually put to death, one surmises the death penalty is listed here in order to emphasize how terrible cursing a parent is. Verse 18. If men quarrel, and one strikes the other with stone or fist, and he does not die but has to take to his bed. Verse 19. If he then gets up and walks outdoors upon his staff, the assailant shall go unpunished, except that he must pay for his idleness and his cure. The assailant described here is engaged in a fight with the person he hit, and therefore is not regarded as necessarily more in the wrong than the person who was injured. Nonetheless, he still has to face the consequences of his actions, and must therefore compensate the victim for the time during which he was unable to work and for his medical expenses. The word shivto, translated here as idleness, and which literally means his sitting, refers to the time the injured man is unable to work. If a slave is beaten and dies. Verse 20. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and he dies there and then, he must be avenged. When a human life is taken by intent or by reckless endangerment, it must be avenged. Thus, like any murderer, a master who murders his slave is subject to the death penalty. Sarna points out that of all the ancient Near Eastern law codes, the Torah is unique in protecting slaves from homicide and other forms of maltreatment by their masters. Exodus chapter 21, verses 26 through 27. Verse 21. But if he survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, since he is the other's property. This verse sounds troubling, because in this translation, and many others, it appears to say if a master beats his slave and the slave dies after a day or two, nothing happens to the master. But this may not be what the verse intends to say. Again, as always, we must first go to the Hebrew original. But if he stands for a day or two, he is not avenged. The Hebrew does not say survives. It says stands. This literal reading may imply that if the slave is not so injured as to be unable to get up, the master is not put to death if the slave dies sometime later. Of course, if a tooth or eye was knocked out, or a leg or arm permanently injured, the slave went free. In other words, if the slave is strong enough to get up and stand for a day or two, the master is not punished with a death sentence, see previous verse. Reinforcing this read is the highly regarded NIV, New International Version translation. But they, the master, are not to be punished if the slave recovers after a day or two. 3,000 years ago, when medicine was usually worthless and often harmful, people generally died from severe beatings, and if they recovered for a day or two, it was not assumed it was the beating that caused the person's death. Moreover, if the beaten slave did not stand for a day or two and then died, the master was liable for the death penalty. Regarding the seemingly callous statement that he is the other's property, it is undoubtedly meant to convey the idea that no rational master would want to lose a slave, given how valuable a slave was. Now, of course, one can imagine a very wealthy master who doesn't care about his monetary loss, or a sadistic master who would beat his slave to within an inch of his life. Nevertheless, even a master who was so wealthy he didn't care about the freeing of any number of slaves, and one doubts there were many such people, would have to be concerned about causing the death of the slave within a day, because he, the master, would not merely lose a slave, he would lose his own life. As regards a sadistic master, he would have to be quite concerned about injuring, not to mention causing the death of, a slave, because merely knocking out one tooth of a slave meant the slave would go free. As verses 26 through 27 in this chapter state, when a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let the slave go free because of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his slave, male or female, he shall let the slave go free because of his tooth. And further protecting every slave was the Torah law that no one may return a runaway slave to his master, Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 15. That law alone afforded unparalleled rights to slaves, whether Israelite or non-Israelite. In addition, the words, "he is the other's property," seem to suggest this verse does not apply to a Hebrew slave, since no Hebrew slave was property. This narrows the verse's applicability to foreign slaves, usually procured in a war. And compared to the treatment of captured slaves in all other societies, where killing, torturing, or otherwise injuring a slave was in no way punishable, the Torah's many protections of the foreign slave are unique. Joachim Jeremias, 1900 to 1979, a German Lutheran biblical scholar and member of the British Academy, described the Jews' treatment of Gentile slaves as a great deal more humane than elsewhere in the ancient world. That conclusion is not surprising, given the previous verse's equation of a slave's life to that of all other human beings, the implicit prohibition of mistreating a slave because of the ban on returning a runaway slave, the automatic freeing of a slave if he lost an eye or a tooth at the master's hand, and the Ten Commandments mandate that slaves rest every Sabbath. Essay: The one mention of premature birth in the Torah. Verse 22. When men fight and one of them pushes a pregnant woman and a miscarriage results, but no other damage, ason, ensues, the one responsible shall be fined according as the woman's husband may exact from him, the payment to be based on reckoning. Verse 23. But if other damage, ason, ensues, the penalty shall be life for life. Verse 24. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Verse 25. Burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. The Torah now treats a third type of killing. Verse 12 refers to premeditated homicide. Verse 13 to accidental killing, and these verses, 22 through 25, to a type of killing that is unintentional yet not fully accidental, somewhat corresponding to what is known in the United States as involuntary manslaughter. The words in verse 22, Vyatsu Yiladea, translated here as, and a miscarriage results, literally mean, and her children leave her. See below. It is not at all clear why the verse speaks of children in the plural. Many students of the Bible either find these verses less than entirely clear or even misunderstand them. One difficulty is, why would the death penalty apply, given that the killing is neither premeditated nor intentional? The Talmud offers a plausible answer. The two men were trying to kill one another. If the pregnant woman and or the children, see below, was killed, the deaths may be considered a form of premeditated murder. Regarding the plural word children, this probably referred to a specific case that prompted this ruling, given that the text goes out of its way to specify the woman was pregnant with more than one child. There is, however, a more important difficulty. Does the word ason, translated as damage or harm, refer to the pregnant woman, to the children she is carrying, or to either of them? The answer, I believe, lies in a literal translation of the text. If men are fighting one another, and they hit a pregnant woman, and her children leave her, and if there is no harm, ason, he shall surely be punished according to what the woman's husband lays on him. He will give according to judgment. But if there is harm, ason, you shall give life for a life, eye for an eye. A literal reading of the text can only mean harm has come to either the pregnant woman or to the children who leave her. So then, why is there confusion? It is due to the translation of the words Vyatsu Yiladea, and her children leave her, in this JPS translation and in other translations. I have consulted dozens of translations, and few of them translate Vyatsu Yeladeha as miscarriage. Virtually every translation is a variation on the King James translation, her fruit depart. This includes even some Jewish translations, such as the earlier JPS translation, 1917, which translates the words as her fruit depart, as does the English translation provided by Bar Ilan University, Israel's preeminent Orthodox university. In fact, we know in the Torah, a live birth, not a miscarriage, is described using the same verb, to leave, as in this verse. See, for example, Genesis chapter 25, verses 25 through 26, when Rebekah gives birth to Esau and Jacob, both of whom are said to leave her or are born alive. Likewise, the second word, yiladea, her children, is also used elsewhere to refer to the birth of children. For example, Genesis chapter 33, verse 7, Exodus chapter 21, verse 4, and later in the Bible, in Ruth chapter 1, verse 5. The Hebrew verb yatsah, meaning to go forth or leave, is used over 500 times in the Hebrew Bible, and often refers to the emergence of a living being. See Genesis chapter 1, verse 24, Genesis chapter 8, verse 17, Genesis chapter 15, verse 4, 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 19, Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5, 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 18. And as significantly, the verb never means miscarriage, except in Numbers chapter 12, verse 12, where the verse explicitly states the baby is born dead. Moreover, there are two biblical words for miscarriage, shakal and nephal, and neither is used here. Shakal is used four times, Genesis chapter 31, verse 38, Job chapter 3, verse 16, Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verses 3 through 4, and Psalms 58, verse 9 in the Jewish numbering, Psalms 58, verse 8 in Christian numbering. And it means miscarriage in each case. Nephal is used three times, Exodus chapter 23, verse 26, Hosea chapter 9, verse 14, and Job chapter 21, verse 10. And it means miscarriage in each case, or abort in the verse from Job. Now, let us return to the verse. If the words are translated as miscarriage, for which there is no Torah or later biblical basis, the text would read, "If there is a miscarriage and harm, a son ensues." It could only mean the Torah does not consider the premature death or injury of the children as harm. But when the words are literally translated as, "her children leave her," meaning the pregnant woman's children have been expelled from the woman's womb, the words, "if there is harm," apply to the children, or to the mother, or to both. It therefore seems clear that what the verses are saying is this. If the mother gives birth and there is no harm to either her or to the children, the husband goes to the court, which finds the man who induced premature birth. But if there is harm, a son, whether injury or death, to either the children or the mother, then punishment is life for a life, eye for an eye, etc. I recognize this literal reading of the Torah passage contradicts a widespread Jewish understanding of these verses, which translates "her children leave her" as miscarriage, and therefore regards the premature death of the children as only demanding monetary compensation. But I believe the only fair reading of the verses, given the other times the Torah and the Bible use either the verb "leave" or the noun "children," describes the birth of a child, either healthy or injured, or dead. Essay, Abortion. While I believe there is no valid reason to translate "viyatsu yiladea," her children leave her, as a miscarriage, that does not mean we can infer the Torah's view of all abortions from this verse. We can only infer the Torah views the value of a fetal life that is recognizably human, or perhaps viable, since "child" in the Torah refers to a viable child, to be equal to that of all other human beings. My own view, which plays no role in my explanation of these verses, is that most non-medical abortions, abortions undertaken solely as a form of birth control, or, for example, aborting a female fetus because one wants a male baby, are not morally defensible. I should add, this position concerns the morality of abortion, not the question of its legality. What now follows is a brief summary of traditional Jewish and Christian views on abortion. The Jewish view. Jewish law has been somewhat ambiguous on this issue. For example, ancient Jewish law considered abortions performed by non-Jews a capital crime. This somewhat puzzling position was probably due to ancient rabbis' perceptions that the non-Jewish societies in which they lived had little regard for human life, whereas Jews would perform abortions only in the rarest of circumstances, such as rape or a threat to the life of the mother. Thus, Maimonides ruled, a son of Noah, that is a non-Jew who killed a person, even a fetus in its mother's womb, is capitally liable. The ancient rabbis also ruled that prior to 40 days, the fetus was not considered a human being. However, Orthodox Jews generally regard abortions as forbidden in all but the most extenuating circumstances, almost always regarding the health of the mother, and on rare occasions, the emotional health of the woman, such as a woman who is raped or is carrying, for example, a Tay-Sachs baby. The contemporary Orthodox Jewish position is summarized on the website of the Orthodox Jewish organization Aish. The easiest way to conceptualize a fetus in halakha, Jewish law, is to imagine it as a full-fledged human being, but not quite. In most circumstances, the fetus is treated like any other person. There is even disagreement regarding whether the prohibition of abortion is biblical or rabbinic. Nevertheless, it is universally agreed the fetus will become a full-fledged human being, and there must be a very compelling reason to allow for abortion. As a general rule, abortion in Judaism is permitted only if there is a direct threat to the life of the mother by carrying the fetus to term or through the act of childbirth. The positions of non-Orthodox Jewish movements, specifically Conservative and Reform Judaism, generally allow for abortion in cases of endangerment to the pregnant woman's psychological and emotional well-being, as well as her physical health. In the words of the Union for Reform Judaism, any decision should be left up to the woman within whose body the fetus is growing. Nevertheless, the Reform movement adds that abortion should never be used for birth control purposes. The Christian view. Regarding the traditional Christian position, the Greek language Septuagint, a very early, if not the earliest, translation of the Hebrew Bible, dating from the 3rd century BCE, rendered the form ason as form. Thus, the verse would read, "But if there is form, then you will give a life for a life." While ason does not literally mean form, it always means harm in the Torah. See Genesis chapter 42, verses 4 and 38, chapter 44, verse 29, and Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 and 23. The Septuagint was not necessarily wrong in its intent, because yilideah, her children, does seem to refer only to born children in Torah Hebrew. So the verse may indeed refer only to formed children coming forth from the pregnant woman. Some early Christians, relying on the Septuagint translation, held that if there is no form to the expelled fetus, the man who induced the pregnant woman to expel her fetus would be fined. But if there is form, then you will give life for life. The seminal Catholic thinker Augustine, 354 to 430, relying on the Greek Septuagint, drew a distinction between an embryo, informatus, unformed, and an embryo formatus, formed, with only the formed equivalent to full human being. Even in his day, however, Augustine's view of ason as meaning formed was not the dominant church view. Another church father, Jerome, 347 to 420, who lived at the same time as Augustine, also translated the Bible, and did not translate ason as formed. The Catholic position on abortion is expressed thus in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Human life must be respected and protected absolutely from the moment of conception. From the first moment of his existence, a human being must be recognized as having the rights of a person, among which is the inviolable right of every innocent being to life. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5. Since the first century, the Church has affirmed the moral evil of every procured abortion. This teaching has not changed and remains unchangeable. Direct abortion, that is to say, abortion willed either as an end or a means, is gravely contrary to the moral law. From the beginning of Protestant Christianity in the 16th century, the Protestant position was the same. I will only cite John Calvin, 1509 to 1564, one of the first and most important Protestant theologians. In his commentary on Exodus chapter 21, verse 22, he wrote, "The unborn, though enclosed in the womb of his mother, is already a human being, and it is an almost monstrous crime to rob it of life which it has not yet begun to enjoy." Liberal Protestant denominations do not condemn abortions, holding that each woman must decide what is right. The Presbyterian Church USA, for example, upholds the ability and responsibility of women, guided by the Scriptures and the Holy Spirit, to make good moral choices in regard to problem pregnancies. In sum, whatever one concludes from these verses, the first task of the intellectually honest is to know what they say. Essay, Eye for an Eye, One of the Great Moral Advances in History. In Jewish history, this list of punishments, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise, was never taken literally. Only a life for life was taken literally, because the Torah meant it literally. The Torah repeatedly demands the taking of the life of one who commits premeditated murder. See, for example, Exodus chapter 21, verse 14. God himself announces in Genesis that taking the life of a murderer is part of the moral foundation of civilization. Genesis chapter 9, verse 6. However, none of the others, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, etc., were ever meant to be taken literally, because they could not possibly be taken literally. If you take a man's eye out, you may easily end up killing him. The same holds true regarding the taking of a hand or a foot. And it is certainly not possible to burn, wound, or bruise a person exactly as he burned, wounded, or bruised his victim. Any of these would upset the moral balance constituting the entire point of the Lex Talionis, law of retaliation as these laws are known. Thus, throughout Jewish history, the assailant was required to pay monetary compensation for any limbs and organs he damaged. Many people regard the Lex Talionis as morally primitive. Mahatma Gandhi's biographer Louis Fisher said, in summarizing Gandhi's views, "An eye for an eye will make the whole world blind." Fisher said this view emanated from Gandhi's commitment to pacifism and doctrine of nonviolence. But this commitment also led Gandhi to recommend to the Jews of Nazi-occupied Europe they not engage in or support any violent resistance to Hitler, and to recommend to the British soldiers in the spring of 1940, when Hitler seemed poised to take over Europe, to lay down their arms, not fight the Nazis, and let the Nazis occupy England. In Gandhi's own words, "If these gentlemen, the Nazis, choose to occupy your homes, you will vacate them. If they do not give you free passage out, you will allow yourselves, man, woman, and child, to be slaughtered, but you will refuse to owe allegiance to them." Dismissing the Lex Talionis as primitive is simply wrong. This principle of equal punishment is a fundamental statement of the Torah's preoccupation with justice. It represents, on several levels, a revolutionary moral advance over other ancient cultures' morality. First, Lex Talionis is the ultimate statement of human equality. No one's eye is worth more than the eye of anyone else. This was new in history. For example, the Babylonian Code of Hammurabi, considered one of the great moral advances of ancient civilization, legislated the eye of a noble was of much greater value than the eye of a commoner. It therefore imposed different fines depending on the status of the person whose eye was taken. Second, the principle of an eye for an eye ensured only the guilty party was punished for his crime. In contrast, to cite yet another example from Hammurabi's code, if a builder erected a house for a client and the house collapsed, killing the client's daughter, the builder's daughter was to be executed, Law 229. Torah law differed from this law in two ways. First, the Torah made special provisions for accidental homicide and did not allow for execution in such a case. Second and most important, the biblical principle of an eye for an eye ensured no one other than the guilty party should suffer punishment. In Deuteronomy, the Torah formalized this prohibition. Parents shall not be put to death for children, nor children be put to death for parents. A person shall be put to death only for his own crime. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 16. Third, the Lex Talionis is based on justice and therefore prohibits unjust revenge. In the ancient Near East and elsewhere, if a man gouged out another man's eye, the victim would likely seek out a violent revenge, such as gouging out both the attacker's eyes, killing him, gouging out his children's eyes, etc. In contrast, this principle teaches that the victim receives the appropriate compensation for the damages he suffered and is permitted to exact no more. Fourth, the Torah is preoccupied with justice, and it recognizes it is profoundly unjust for a person who has deliberately and unjustly gouged out the eye of another person to keep his own eye. Perfect justice, therefore, would dictate that what I deliberately did to an innocent person be done to me. Of course, except for taking a murderer's life, this is not possible. As noted, no eye or foot can ever be damaged in precisely the same way one damaged the eye or foot of another. Therefore, the Lex Talionis was always understood to be a statement of ideal, though impracticable, justice. And justice is the Torah's paramount concern. The only doubled noun commandment in the Torah is the repetition of the word justice in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 20. Justice, justice you shall pursue. Many people object to an eye for an eye on the grounds it calls for revenge, not justice. But revenge is a loaded word. It invariably communicates a morally negative message. Yet, just as there is just and unjust violence, there is just and unjust revenge. After all, just about every punishment has an element of revenge. The moment one seeks to inflict any form of pain on an evildoer, one is engaged in revenge. Opponents of capital punishment for murderers often argue murderers should be given a life sentence in prison without the possibility of parole. But isn't that a form of revenge? In fact, some societies do take the position punishment is essentially revenge, and therefore do not sentence even the most sadistic murderers or even mass murderers to anything approaching a life sentence. To cite one well-known example, in 2011, a Norwegian named Anders Behring Breivik, a self-described fascist and national socialist, murdered 77 people, most of them young, at a summer camp in Norway. He was sentenced to 21 years in prison, the maximum sentence Norway permits for any crime. Norway is not alone in regarding the desire to see an evildoer suffer at least something analogous to the suffering he inflicted on his victims as revenge, a primitive human impulse that must be expunged. I don't. Nor, apparently, does the Torah. On the contrary, the desire to pluck out the eye of a person who deliberately plucked out the eye of an innocent person is actually very human in the best sense of the word. It seems to me anyone who does not want to see a person experience the suffering he deliberately inflicted on an innocent person lacks empathy as well as the most elementary sense of morality and justice. Therefore, even a monetary fine would seem insufficient punishment in many cases. A long prison sentence would seem far more just. However, we do not know of the existence of prisons as such in the Torah. Verse 26. When a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. As noted in verse 20, the Torah is unique in protecting slaves from homicide. It is similarly unique in protecting slaves from other forms of maltreatment by their masters. Although verse 21 describes a slave as property, verse 26 makes it clear this fact does not allow the owner of this human property to be abusive. A slave, too, is a human being. Job, in asserting his essential goodness as a human being, points to his treatment of his slaves. Did I ever brush aside the case of my servants, man or maid, when they made a complaint against me? Job chapter 31, verse 13. Casuto writes, the Torah is the only ancient law code that includes a punishment for mistreating a slave. In all other codes, a man would not be punished for harming a slave any more than he would be punished for breaking some inanimate object he owed. The Torah, in contrast, is concerned with the welfare of the mistreated slave, because the slave, though owned, is a human being, not an object. In at least four ways, Torah law's treatment of slaves was morally superior to what prevailed in, for example, the United States until the end of slavery in the 1860s. 1. A slave was freed if a master ruined the slave's eye or just knocked out a tooth. Exodus chapter 21, verses 26 through 27. 2. It was forbidden to return a runaway slave to his master. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 16. 3, slave owners who killed a slave were to be executed. Exodus chapter 21, verse 20. 4, slaves were to desist from work on the Sabbath, just as their owners did. Exodus chapter 20, verse 12. Verse 27. If he knocks out the tooth of his slave, male or female, he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. Beno Yaakov points out that although a master is not forbidden from hitting his slaves, he will have to pay dearly if a beating leads to so much as a lost tooth, not to mention a lost eye. It is true a blind slave cannot work efficiently, but a slave's effectiveness is hardly impaired by a lost tooth. Clearly, then, the consequences suffered by an owner for injuring a slave have nothing to do with whether or not the slave is still fit for labor. The fact that the loss of an eye and a tooth are equated, even though the former is an infinitely more serious loss, underscores the law's intention to protect a slave from permanent harm or cruel discipline. Why kill an ox that killed a person? Verse 28. When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned. Usually the Torah uses the word man to refer to a man or woman. In these laws, however, the Torah constantly repeats the phrase a man or a woman to emphasize the lives of both are identical in value. As regards the stoning of the ox, Nahum Sarna comments on this verse at length and addresses the issue of just how seriously the Torah regards the killing of a human being. The killer ox is not destroyed solely because it is dangerous. This is clear from the fact it is not destroyed when the victim is another ox, and from the prescribed mode of destruction, not ordinary slaughter, but stoning. The execution of the ox was carried out in the presence and with the participation of the entire community, implying the killing of a human being is a source of mass pollution, and the proceedings had an expiatory function. The killing of a homicidal beast is ordained in Genesis chapter 9, verses 5 through 6. For your own lifeblood I will require a reckoning. I will require it of every beast. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in his image did God make man. The sanctity of human life is such as to make bloodshed the consummate offense, one viewed with unspeakable horror. Both man and beast that destroy human life are thereafter tainted by blood guilt. Sarna's explanation is undoubtedly correct. The stoning of the animal is society's way of demonstrating how terrible killing a human being is, whether done by man, by choice, or by an animal by instinct. This was once brought home to me on my radio show. A woman whose family raised ostriches called to tell me her beloved father had been killed by one of their ostriches. I asked her what, if anything, was done to the ostrich. She replied that nothing was done to the animal. So I asked, when people visit, you just point to the ostrich and say, "That's the ostrich that killed my dad?" "Yes," she answered unhesitatingly. I respectfully told her that unless her father was deliberately tormenting the ostrich, I thought that showed disrespect to her father, that it sort of made light of his killing. Were it not for this Torah law, I don't know if I would have reacted as strongly as I did. Verse 28 continued, "And its flesh shall not be eaten." There must be no benefit derived from an animal that kills a human being. Verse 28 continued, "But the owner of the ox is not to be punished." The Hebrew word naki, translated as "not to be punished," literally means clean and signifies the owner of the ox is clean of moral blemish or fault. Prior to this incident, he had no way of knowing his ox was dangerous. Verse 29, "If, however, that ox has been in the habit of goring, and its owner, though warned, had failed to guard it, and he kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner, too, shall be put to death." The Torah now refers to a case in which an ox is known to have gored people previously. This ox does not have to have killed anyone else already. A history of goring is sufficient to render the owner negligent. Though the owner has been warned of his ox's goring tendencies, he has failed to either lock up the animal or remove its horns. The owner may be compared to a judge who repeatedly lets drunk drivers get off easy. It is likely one of those drivers, like the goring ox, will go on to cause a fatal accident. From the tourist perspective, the owner who fails to take care of his goring ox is functionally equivalent to a murderer, since the ox is, in effect, a loaded weapon, not kept under lock and key. Verse 30. If ransom is laid upon him, he must pay whatever is laid upon him to redeem his life. In general, the Torah does not permit a person to pay ransom for his life when he is deserving of capital punishment. You may not accept a ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of a capital crime. He must be put to death. Numbers chapter 35, verse 31. The owner of the ox is an exception because he is not morally equivalent to a man who's committed premeditated murder. Although he is responsible for the death of another human being, he has killed his ox's victim indirectly and through negligence rather than intent. Therefore, in this exceptional instance, he is granted the option of paying a ransom for his life. Another Torah rejection of the laws of its time. Verse 31. So too, if it gores a minor, male or female, the owner shall be dealt with according to the same rule. Until about 1900, this verse caused quite a bit of confusion. It read like a non sequitur. In assigning punishment to the goring ox's owner, what does it matter if the victim of the attack was someone's son or daughter? However, with the discovery of related ancient Semitic legal codes at the turn of the 20th century, it became clear this law was intended to distinguish Torah law from contemporaneous codes, which ruled that if a man's ox killed another man's son or daughter, then the son or daughter of the ox's owner would be killed. The Torah therefore expressly forbids such reciprocal vicarious punishment. See also Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 16. No matter who is killed, it is the ox's owner alone who is punished, and not his son or daughter. This is an extremely important point for an additional reason. There are undoubtedly other instances in the Torah that can seem odd or even objectionable to us, but which would be understood if we were more conversant with the Near East 3,000 years ago. It is essential to remember the Torah, while eternal in its values, first had to be intelligible and create a moral revolution in the late Bronze Age. Verse 32. But if the ox gores a slave, male or female, he shall pay 30 shekels of silver to the master, and the ox shall be stoned. The ox is killed, just as it would be if the ox gored a free person. Verse 33. When a man opens a pit, or digs a pit, and does not cover it, and an ox or an ass falls into it, verse 34, the one responsible for the pit must make restitution. He shall pay the price to the owner. Even though the digger of the pit did not hurt the other man's animal deliberately, he is nonetheless negligent. Verse 34 continued, but shall keep the dead animal. Verse 35, when a man's ox injures his neighbor's ox and it dies, they shall sell the live ox and divide its price. They shall also divide the dead animal. In this context, divide means they shall divide the value of the dead animal. When bad things happen, there isn't always a villain. In contrast to the previous case involving the pit, this verse refers not to a matter of negligence, but to an accident. The owner of the ox has done nothing wrong. He had no way of preventing his ox from injuring his neighbor's animal. While the owner of the goring ox is responsible for his animal, he need restore only half the value of an ox to his neighbor, since the incident is understood to be an accident. This approach should be contrasted to contemporary societies in which accidents are rarely recognized as such. People just want to assign blame. The Torah, however, acknowledges a more nuanced reality. Sometimes things happen that are beyond people's control. True, an accident has occurred and a victim has suffered. But in a certain sense, the owner too, having had no reason to anticipate such behavior from what might well have been an unaggressive, even mild-mannered animal, is also a victim. To hold him responsible for all payments would constitute a judgment of negligence against him. So, the Torah splits the payment between the ox's owner and the dead animal's owner. Telushkin notes, while this might not be a perfect solution, the alternatives offered in a litigious society are certainly not superior. A friend embarrassedly confessed to me that when a nanny tripped in his house, She simply lost her footing. There was no object on the floor. His first concern was that she would sue him. A litigious society causes people to view people they unintentionally hurt or who are simply hurt on the owner's property, even when the owner is not at fault, as potential plaintiffs rather than simply as a fellow human who was hurt. Consequently, many people even hesitate to say, "I'm sorry," lest that be an admission of guilt in a lawsuit against them. In short, the Torah understood sometimes sad things happen and injuries result, with no one really at fault. In other words, just because there is a victim doesn't mean there is a villain. Verse 36. If, however, it is known that the ox was in the habit of goring, and its owner has failed to guard it, he must restore ox for ox, but shall keep the dead animal. In this case, the owner of the ox is culpable, because he failed to control an ox known for its goring tendencies. He must make full restitution. Verse 37. When a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. Since the thief has deliliberately stolen from another, he must pay that person not only restitution for the stolen goods, but an additional amount as punishment for his crime. In addition to deserving punishment, there is another reason for the fine. If all the thief was required to do was restore what he stole, he would have no reason not to steal again, since the worst that could happen would be he had to return what he took. As regards the reason for the higher-than-normal fines imposed on the thief for stealing an ox, oxen were more essential to one's livelihood in ancient Israelite society, since they could perform hard labor. Therefore, the penalty for stealing an ox was greater than the penalty for stealing a sheep. Chapter 22. Note to reader. There is a different enumeration of verses in this chapter between Jewish and Christian editions of the Bible. In the Christian enumeration, the first verse of this chapter is the last verse of the preceding chapter. Therefore, what is listed here as chapter 22 verse 1 is chapter 22 verse 2 in Christian editions, meaning that each verse in this chapter is one verse behind the Christian enumeration. Verse 1. If the thief is seized while tunneling and he is beaten to death. This chapter opens with a case in which an individual or a family is confronted with a thief clandestinely breaking into their home. This verse is understood as referring to a case in which the thief is intruding at night, at a time when the members of a household are expected to be home. It can be assumed, therefore, that such an intruder is prepared to encounter opposition and to kill if necessary. Verse 1 continued, there is no blood guilt in his case. One who kills a nighttime invader is assumed to have acted in self-defense and is not charged with murder. As regards all instances in which a person has good reason to fear an assailant might kill him, the Talmud teaches a basic principle of Jewish jurisprudence. If one comes to kill you, wake up early, that is, anticipate him, and kill him first. Verse 2. If the sun has risen on him, there is blood guilt in that case. In the daytime, the members of a household are not expected to be at home. Consequently, a thief who intrudes at this time, particularly if not armed, is not assumed to have homicidal intent. One who is not in physical danger and kills such a thief is therefore charged with killing. As Sarna explains, the biblical scales give priority to the protection of life, even the life of a burglar, over the protection of property. As the Talmud later put it, if it is as clear to you as the sun is shining that the burglar is not a physical threat to you, then you will bear guilt for killing him. All this, of course, is based on individual circumstance. A daytime intruder who is armed and obviously willing to murder should be confronted and, if necessary, killed. Verse 2 continued, he, the thief, must make restitution. As a rule, the thief has to pay double the value of what he has stolen. See verses 3 and 6. Verse 2 continued, if he lacks the means, he shall be sold for his theft. The Torah recognizes a thief owes money to the person from whom he stole. Therefore, if he cannot pay it, he is sold into indentured servitude, slavery, and must work off his debt until he makes full restitution. regarding the notion of indentured servitude slavery, which strikes modern readers as morally disturbing, see commentary to Exodus chapter 21, verse 2. Verse 3. But if what he stole, whether ox or ass or sheep, is found alive in his possession, he shall pay double. The final verse in chapter 21, the first verse of this chapter in the Christian enumeration, legislated that a thief must pay 5 oxen for every ox stolen and slaughtered, and 4 sheep for every sheep.